Hello, everyone, and thank you so much, David, for that nice introduction and for everyone who brought me here and helped put it all together. As I've been sort of giving some of these speeches, and even during those 8 years of working on the book, I've been thinking about quantum mechanics and language, and because I've given speeches to audiences like you where there are many physicists present, but sometimes I've given speeches where, you know, no one is a physicist and they're terrified. I'm terrified. And people come up afterwards and they're like, you know, for me, math is just a foreign language. And I was hearing this a lot, and I started thinking, well, maybe this is kind of a valuable way to approach it, because there are hundreds of languages out there, and they don't all translate with equal ease into each other, and we got, you know, some like Spanish that are pretty easy to translate into English, and others, for example, Chinese, are much harder, and there's much more subtlety about the whole thing. And so I was doing internet research about Chinese, which I know nothing about, and I was learning about these compound words. And so we have compound words in English, and things like a boat that you live on is a houseboat. But I'm a shepherd, so I was really excited to see that the character for sheep plus the character for I becomes a character for all these wonderful virtues, justice, and so forth. And because sheep are underappreciated in this country, but it's, that will change with my third book. Obviously a lot gets lost. A lot gets lost in translation. But nobody says you shouldn't translate great works of literature into other languages, and so I began to think this is sort of what I'm attempting to do, to translate quantum mechanics to give non-mathematical people a kind of vague sense of what's there, because of course the language of quantum mechanics is math, and so I thought I should. Anyway, it was good to start with the disclaimer that I'm going to use English. But it's only approximation for what we're talking about. And you know, with quantum mechanics, we talk about things like wave-particle duality and... I don't know how to go back. Yeah. Those were nice waves, too. But I like my waves and particles screen that... particularly the Mark Twain picture. But anyway... And here we have these English words, you know, waves and particles, and we know that what we're talking about with quantum mechanics isn't a wave and it's not a particle. It's just we don't have words, and we use English words to kind of gesture towards it. And in particular, both Niels Bohr and Erwin Schrödinger talked a lot about this issue. And for Schrödinger, it was a big problem, and he felt that quantum mechanics is in trouble because we're using words almost in contradiction to what their natural meanings would be. These words' meanings change so much when we apply them to quantum mechanics that is there a point to using these words anymore? And he repeatedly uses the metaphor of the Spanish boot, which is an instrument of torture which may or may not be lined with spikes, but you crank it tighter and tighter on someone's foot until they confess or whatever it is. And Schrödinger wrote, does one not get the feeling that the essential content of what is being said can only with some difficulty be forced into the Spanish boot of a prediction of probability of finding this or that measurement? Does not one get the impression that here one deals with fundamental properties of new classes of characteristics that keep only the name in common with the classical meanings. But Bohr Bohr had a different approach, and he would say that, you know, classical language, this is what we've got. What do you recommend we, what words do you recommend we start using? We are suspended in language. Our task is to communicate, which communication's not so easy. Before I go any further, I thought I would admit to everyone that I wasn't a physicist, but David's explained that, so that's good. I went to college to be a physics major because I'd been so excited. My father, who is sort of interested in these things, would tell me when I was a little kid, you know, that this is mostly empty space and that electrons seem like they can go through two holes at the same time. And it was so cool. And then, of course, sometimes the coolness isn't, it's hard for professors who've got to teach you all sorts of things to remember that it's exciting. And anyway, I didn't have the stick-to-itiveness. So anyway, I had this sort of minorly life-changing experience, and it was exactly 10 years ago, practically to the day, and I remember the day so vividly. It was my junior winter after I'd given up on physics, but I was taking a philosophy of science class, and I had this paper to read, and I was reading it in the music library at Dartmouth, which is this wonderful place where they give you the big padded earphones, and you go off into your little world. And I was listening to David Grisman play the mandolin and reading this paper by David Merman called Quantum Mysteries for Anyone. And so here we got David Grisman and then famous mandolin players during the time period when the people who were trying to understand the meaning of, you know, trying to understand the atom, beginning to come up against what would ultimately be realized as quantization. And so this romantic, forlorn mandolin player from the 1870s, this is when Rutherford is a tiny baby and Mendeleev has just published his first version of the periodic table, and the word electron has just been coined, but not found yet by J.J. Thomson, and Maxwell. People are studying spectroscopy, where you're looking at the spectral lines of elements, and Maxwell, the great James Clerk Maxwell, was saying, you know, it looks like these atoms are much more complicated than we were innocently believing. So that was sort of the 1870s. And by 1900, you know, photography has come into play. It's to the point where you can wander through the Appalachian Mountains and take pictures of mandolin players way out in the backwoods. And of course, over in Berlin in 1900, Max Planck is reluctantly saying, you know, I think we're going to have to introduce this this idea of quantization. And by 1909, when Picasso is dallying in Paris with this mandolin player, Einstein is at a speech in Salzburg saying the physics of the future is going to have to somehow involve a fusion of particle ideas and wave ideas. And Lisa Meitner, among others, were in the audience, and the report was that just nobody followed. What is Einstein talking about? this paper totally changed my life, and because entanglement is just so fascinating, and it was amazing to me that here I was. So what was being presented in this paper was that particles, so to speak, that have interacted can separate for arbitrary distances and apparently are still one thing or are, you know, instantaneously affecting each other. I mean, it wasn't clear what was going on, but it was something very sort of magical, and it amazed me that here we'd been spending years studying these equations and it hadn't come up. And you know, when I asked, you know, why didn't it come up, people say, oh, well, you know, it's entanglement's not a big deal. The helium atom, those two electrons, who we got some hydrogen orbitals, but of course, where hydrogen has just one electron kind of whatever it is smeared out in its little, helium's got the two, and they don't seem to be individuals. But it's not a big deal because it's just in a little tiny atom, and you know, and but the point of entanglement is that there's no simple logical way to explain that situation, and it's one thing. Maybe it's not so important if it's in a tiny atom, which that doesn't seem like a very good argument. But then it's really mind-boggling if they can be separated by arbitrary distances, and of course the name that the man who did the most for pointing out, well, there's something really strange going on here. Is John Bell, but it was Einstein in 1930 who was the first to point out that this is not just small scale. We can't just forget about it because it's little. There's nothing in the Schrodinger equation that suggests that it's going to die away with distance or it's going to disentangle. And Einstein, and as long as the two entangled entities don't interact with anything else, and of course they're very fickle, so it. But there it is. And Einstein said there are two interpretations of this situation, an obvious one and a preposterous one, and the obvious one, excuse me, is that the particles must share some internal properties. They must, you know, have started out together and received their instructions, and we're just measuring what was already decided. And the preposterous explanation is what he derisively referred to as spooky action at a distance, that you're measuring one affects the other one no matter how far away it was. And he famously said, no reasonable definition of reality can be expected to permit this. But in the 30s, this sort of seemed like a matter of personal preference, how you viewed this. And most physicists just sort of went on their way, which probably was the right thing to do at the time. But things went on like that for another 30 years until 1964, when I think he was 36 at the time. 36-year-old Northern Irishman living in Geneva shed some light on the situation. And I'd like to quote from one of his most famous papers on this subject, but before I do, I have to tell a little bit of the back history. This was a paper in the 80s. But in the late 70s, he was working with a young Austrian named Reinhold Bertelmann, and that's Bell's drawing of Bertelmann, and Bertelmann was on one of these, at CERN they have sort of 3-year stints where visiting scientists come and work at CERN, and Bertelmann was on one of these, and he quite early started working with Bell, and fairly soon after they met, Bell noticed that Bertelmann always wore mismatched socks, and day after day, Bertelmann would come into Bell's office, and they'd go off to have green tea at the CERN canteen, and Bell would kind of look, and yep, mismatched socks again today. But being a privacy-respecting Brit and privacy-respecting Switzerland, Bell never said anything about this to Bertelmann, never commented, and he also never told Bertelmann anything about his work in quantum mechanics. It was his secret hobby, and when I later got to meet many of Bell's colleagues from the 60s, from the 70s, from the 80s, and most of them would say, I had no idea Bell was working on this stuff. He was doing quantum field theory. Bell kept it a secret. So Bertelmann's 3 years came up, and he went back to Vienna, and he found himself followed quite swiftly by a paper titled Bertelmann Socks and the Nature of Reality. And he really thought Bell was pulling a practical joke on him. So the paper was Bell's attempt to catch the, it had been, this was almost 20 years after Bell had first published what's called Bell's Theorem. And, you know, not very many people had, Bell was trying to catch the attention of a wider audience. So the beginning of the paper says, the philosopher on the street who has not suffered a course in quantum mechanics is quite unimpressed by these correlations of entanglement. He can point to many similar examples in everyday life. The case of Bertelmann's socks is often cited. Dr. Bertelmann likes to wear different socks of two different colors, and which color he will have on a given foot on a given day is quite unpredictable. But when you see that the first sock is pink, you may already be certain that the second sock will not be pink. There's no accounting for tastes. Observation of the first and experience of Bertelmann give immediate information about the second sock. There's no accounting for tastes, but apart from that, there's no mystery here. And is not this entanglement business just the same? And of course, he goes on in this paper to show why this entanglement business is not just the same. There is no way for these particles to have properties. If they were socks, there would be no way for them to have colors, unchangeable, their own personal colors. They're either they share pinkness and orangeness, and then one becomes one when it's measured, or else they have colors, but they're instantly changeable. And both of these, there's no way to get around. Everybody wants to make it. There's got to be a way it makes sense, and it makes sense only in the language of mathematics and not in English. Entanglement and disentanglement are happening all the time, everywhere. But what's more rare is entanglement over great distances. And here's the first time. This was demonstrated in the lab. It was in 1972 that they finished the experiment in a basement room in Berkeley. This is John Clauser and Stuart Friedman, and the experiment stretches almost 5 meters. They were demonstrating entanglement with correlated photons emitted from calcium, overheated calcium. But it can go farther, and this is Nicolas Gisin, and in 1997 he and his colleagues demonstrated entanglement using infrared light this time over the fiber optic phone lines of Geneva. I think I wrote down the distance: 9.5 miles. I didn't put it in kilometers, but it's a bunch of kilometers. In another experiment, there was a really, really cool one, I thought. They showed that if measuring one affects what's happening to the other, the influence has to be traveling many, many times faster than the speed of light. They did this experiment where, in relativistic terms, each measuring apparatus is measuring its photon before the other one, so that was really cool. And in 1991, Arthur Eckert, who was then at Cambridge, showed that you can use this entanglement to make an unbreakable code. And Gisset then started a company to sell this quantum cryptography to the public. And apparently, it's at least been a success. The city of Geneva is now using it to protect, actually not a version based on entanglement, but a version based on the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, using quantum cryptography to protect their election results. So it's a real thing. But entanglement is not confined to the city of Geneva. This is 10 years later, in 2007, Anton Zeilinger demonstrated entanglement over open air over the Atlantic between two of the Canary Islands. That's 144 kilometers, 90 miles. There's one little tiny photon seems to be reacting instantly to what happens 90 miles away. And here we've got a characteristic quote from Zeilinger. There's no way to separate reality from information about that reality, so no theory should distinguish between the two. And it seems like philosophy, but here he's an experimental physicist who's led to say such things from hands-on experience. My favorite Zeilinger-led experiment is involving entanglement swapping, and probably some of you have heard about this. It's so wonderful. So you start with two pairs of entangled particles. So let's imagine one pair of entangled particles over here and one pair over here. And you take one of these and one of these and entangle them together. And these, so now we have a new pair of entangled particles. And the two over there that have never met each other and will never meet each other are now entangled. It's like magic. and so then we get to quantum computation. Here are a few of the faces of this field. In the center, it's David Deutsch, who is one of the few people in the 80s. He started talking about a quantum computer, and almost nobody listened. But a few important people did it. And in the early 90s, up in the corner, we've got Seth Lloyd, who showed that it was possible to make one with existing technology. In 1996 and 97, Shore and Grover, the two guys with mustaches, showed that if you made this computer, it would. Shore showed that it could break any code that we now have, and Grover showed that it could search through a database, I think, four times faster than any existing computer. So there was a reason to make one, and Isaac Chuang and Neil Gershenfeld in 1998 built one, and that's it. Well, actually, this is a diagram of it. It's a little molecule, but in that vial holds lots of them. And they factored the number 15 into 5 and 3. I think not a lot of progress. I'm sure lots and lots of progress has made since then, but it's slow. But I loved the explaining the connection between quantum cryptography and quantum computation. Peter Shor wrote a limerick: "If computers that you build are quantum, then spies of all nations, all factions will want them. Our codes will all fail, and they'll read our email till we've crypto that's quantum and daunt them." But so all this is exciting, but why did it wait till 1964, and it all stems from Bell's insight in 1964, but there's no reason that it had to wait till 1964. Bell's theorem could, and I mean, no disrespect to Bell, who is amazing, but There's no reason it had to wait. It could have been thought of any time after 1926. I think that there are two non-scientific reasons why it took so long, and one is personalities, and the other is, in particular, two personalities, and the other is history, both macro history, World War II, and micro history, missed communications. And the two personalities were Einstein and Bohr, who were devoted friends all through their life and, you know, fought on almost every intellectual issue. And they had these famous Bohr-Einstein debates, which actually started earlier than, it started way back in 1924 when Bohr didn't believe that light quanta, that photons were a good idea. And they continued all the way through their lives. But one really important debate that they had was in 1930, and it's been passed down as a continuation of their debates about the uncertainty principle. And this is how Bohr told about this interaction. But it turns out that, they had debated about the uncertainty principle extensively in 1927, but this time round, Einstein was actually trying to get a different idea across to Bohr. In 1931, Ehrenfest, sitting at the piano, was in Caltech, and Einstein was traveling around Europe and America talking about this thought experiment, which Ehrenfest referred to as the light blitz box. And Ehrenfest heard Einstein's speech and talked with him afterwards and realized that the point that Einstein was making then was the point that he'd been trying to make to Bohr. And Ehrenfest was very upset, and he wrote Bohr a long letter saying, Do you know that what he was trying to tell you? Okay, so I have to describe Einstein's thought experiment, which was that, you know, imagine that we've got a box full of radiation, a light-filled box, and we weigh it, and it has a little door that's attached to a clock, and so we let a single photon out, and we've got a mirror 500 light years over there, and which the photon will eventually hit and reflect. And we let the photon travel out there. We wait a couple months. And when we know that the photon's, you know, 300 billion miles away, we can make a choice. We can weigh the box. We've just opened the door for a second and let one photon out. We can weigh the box and find out the mass of that photon. And from the mass, using E equals mc squared, we can get its energy. Or we can check the clock and see when the door opened. And from the clock, we can learn the photons, we can predict the photon's time of arrival. And quantum mechanics won't let us know both of these things. But isn't it kind of odd that it seems that we can control, by what we do with a box 300 billion miles away, we can control what is realized on this photon so far away. But it seems that Bohr didn't get Einstein's point, which was a point of, it was the first time he was really fully bringing up entanglement to Bohr. The photon and the box are entangled. And Bohr didn't get the point in conversation, and then he didn't apparently get the point when Ehrenfest sent the letter, but Ehrenfest was a sensitive guy, and he was worried about Bohr, and time. This was 1931, things were getting pretty stressful, and so he sent the letter to Bohr's wife, Margareta, and he wrote to her, you know, if Bohr is overworked and tired, don't give him the letter, and even if you do give him the letter, tell him that there is absolutely no need for a response. There was no response, and it's not clear whether or not Bohr got the letter, but the letter's preserved. So anyway, Bohr was still, years later, describing Einstein's thought experiment without mentioning entanglement, without mentioning long-distance entanglement. And it was only the third time that Einstein brought this up, which was in the famous Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, that Bohr noticed what Einstein was getting at. So how was it that Bohr didn't get the point? Well, one reason was his style of conversation, and I have this wonderful drawing by George Gamow of Bohr in conversation with Lev Landau, also in 1931. And Landau is bound and gagged, and Bohr's saying, "But Landau, couldn't I just get in one word?" And this was, you know, everybody loved Bohr, but they also all reported that he wasn't a great listener. So that's one reason. But it's a very poignant thing that when Bohr died, they went to his office and one of the drawings, there were two drawings on his blackboard that were up there, and one was of a Riemann surface, this spiral, which Bohr would use as an illustration for how hard it was to communicate with people. And sometimes you spiral back around to a word, but now you mean a different, you're up on a higher level and you mean a different thing, and it's so hard to communicate this with other people. People looking confused. Bohr was a confusing writer, but the other picture is of Einstein's light blitz box. So he may not have got Einstein's point immediately, but he was still thinking about it for the rest of his life. Here's Schrödinger, who's one of the few people to be galvanized by the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, his first description of entanglement. The peculiar situation is the best possible knowledge of a whole does not necessarily include the best possible knowledge of all the parts, even though they may be entirely separated. So Bohr and Schrödinger ultimately responded in a big way to this paper, but why wasn't Bell's theorem found quite soon after that? And of course, one of the answers is, well, World War II came in and sort of distracted everyone. And secondly, the EPR paper had ended with saying that we've shown that the wave function is incomplete. And we believe that a theory is possible that will complete that. And von Neumann had already shown that that was impossible in 1932. But what people didn't know was that von Neumann's proof that there was no way to complete quantum mechanics had already been disproved by 1934, which was not done by a physicist, but by a mathematical philosopher named Greta Hermann. She was a Kantian philosopher, mathematical Kantian philosopher, and Heisenberg had published in the Berlin newspaper that he had dethroned Kant, and he'd overthrown Kant with the uncertainty principle, and she really cared about Kant, and so she came to Leipzig to fight it out with Heisenberg. They were exactly the same age, and she stayed in Leipzig for a year, and one of the things, and Heisenberg describes this conversation in his book, Physics and Reality, or Physics and Beyond, anyway, sorry, one of those books. She said to him, you know, what prevents us from assuming that as our physical knowledge increases, new formulas and rules might be added to quantum mechanics? And everything depends on the answer to this question. And so Heisenberg says, well, you know, von Neumann has shown. And Hermann said, I think if you look at what von Neumann showed, you'll notice that a necessary step to prove the non-existence of such distinguishing characteristics involves the implicit assumption of their non-existence. She proved it mathematically, but she then published this result in her Kantian journal. And so nobody who cared ever read it. But it wasn't fully her fault, because she also published it in I'm sure, I can't say German, so I'm sure I'm going to do a bad job with this, but Der Naturwissenschaften, which is widely read, and it was a journal that had been founded to encourage communication between the various branches of science. And this was a conversation that mathematical formulae were deemed to inhibit, and so the editor just took out the bit about von Neumann. And so Oh, well. But anyway, the point is that human interactions are messy and communication is always difficult. And Bohr had a famous quote about truth and clarity. He said that truth and clarity are complementary. And when you've got more truth, you've got less clarity, and vice versa. But Bell, in conversation with John Wheeler, once said, "Well, I'd rather be clear and wrong than vague and right." So, anyway, that's what I have to say. I think we're at the end of our time, but.
Are there questions?